Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I am Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamond.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you today, Robert?
Today, Russell, I am feeling alternative.
Ah.
And I'm feeling iconic, because that is actually a word that I think describes today's guest very, very well. Mm-hmm. I first met him in 2003, when I was then 22 years old. So it's actually our 20th anniversary of when we first met. Isn't that wild? Because I was working for a PR company at the time in my 20s, when I was in my pop band Tempo Shark, and I was doing the PR for the Alternative Miss World, which happened in 2004 at the Hippodrome in Leicester Square. And it was with Matthew Glamour as well, who was part of the whole Cashpoint club scene that I was in with Bishy and all that crew. And I remember going to Butler's Wharf, I think it was, that studio in London.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and it was filled with jewellery and sculptures. And the one thing I remember is just reflective surfaces. And actually last year, today's guest published a beautiful book called Reflections, which I thought basically sums up the whole thing. It's about the depth of field of vision and very futuristic and inspiring and hopeful. And I know today's guest has just come back from Paris, where he was collaborating with the one and only Stella McCartney, who we are great admirers of. And I know that she likes Talk Art too. So big love to Stella.
Yeah.
And they just collaborated, and there's wearable sculptures and wearable jewellery, which I'm obsessed with. And that's also a big part of today's guest's practice. And we're going to be chatting about their museum in Wales as well, which is the first ever museum for a living artist. And we're both huge fans. So we would like to welcome to Talk Art the living legend that is Andrew Logan. Hi, Andrew.
Hello, Russell. Hey, Rob.
How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Yes, hi.
Where do we find you at the minute? Do we find you in your museum, or do we find you in London?
In our house next to the river. We're next to the museum, and this is it's called the Oldie Courthouse. And Michael, my partner, for 52 years now, Michael Davis, he was gutted when we found it. It's about 16, 18 or something, the building, but it's full of colour. I thought I'd have pink today.
I know, and even the seat is pink. I saw that. It's like you're wearing pink, you're on a pink seat, and you've also got an amazing, what looks like a brooch of a sunshine.
Yes, it was sunshine. Sort of this particular shape. Brooch actually is very nice, because it has you can see it's got a little bee on it. Now that bee, it's an enamel bee, and that was made by Bill Gibb. When I first came to London in the 70s, he was huge. He was like the designer of that time, a marvellous man.
Oh,
very
right.
Original, and everyone copied him. He was called Bill Gibb, Scottish. He was the first person I knew who died of AIDS, and I was there just a couple of days before he died.
Right, wow.
As you know, it sort of swept the nation and what swept the world. So all those wonderful creatives, all those creative people were lost. But he was very funny and original, and I just discovered this the other day, and I thought, oh, I must make Bill go into a little flower. So it's the sun and the flower. I use that motif a lot.
You came into London in the 70s, and you said you've been with your partner 50 odd years now, you said. So that's like, you must have met him, and also in gay years, that's like 9012 or something. So congratulations. But you must have met him as you sort of came to London?
Yes, 1972 we met. It was just after the Alternative Miss World, I think. the first Alternativist World, which was in 1972. And when, as you know, we celebrated, or perhaps you don't know, last year we celebrated our 50th year of the event. 14 events over 50 years. And the winner this year was my sister Janet, who in fact has entered every Alternativist World, never won. So this year, the last one, the last event, there were actually badges in the audience saying, Janet to win, Janet to win. And she was a very modest little outfit, which was great because she won.
Persistence pays off.
So she entered as Miss Golden Girl, and she did every single year since 1972.
Correct.
And finally, she was able to accept the crown. So Alternative Miss World, let's talk about that, as Rob was saying that he was involved in doing the PR for that. And this is something that... If you look at anything about you or read anything about you, it is like the comma after your name. This whole movement, I guess, is something that you invented and you are the perpetual host of since 1972. And I'm a massive Jarman fan, and I know so much of his legacy as well, because he entered and won as Miss Crips Suzette in 1975. And so through him, I've discovered more of Alternative Miss World. And can we talk about this movement, this kind of like, it's a real cultural moment?
Yes. We'll go way back. I think I was about 8 years old, and my parents have five sons and a daughter and a daughter. And I decided I was going to open a happy club. So I remember we had a little, our first meeting was in the garden around a black table. And we then had our first meeting of the happy club. And I always remember, because next door neighbour, we said, well, it's going to be tuppence for the subscription. And tuppence flew over the garden wall. And that was the beginning of the happy club, which of course is still going. It's all my work. It's Alternativist World, it's the sculptures, it's the wearable jewellery, it's everything. And so Alternativist World is, I've always loved giving parties. I was giving parties, parents, you know, go away for the weekend, and then you'd open up your house. But I think the secret with parties, you don't actually need money. I think we live in a world now of huge wealth and sort of spending. But actually, you can have wonderful time. All you need to do is give surprises and just be a good host and hostess.
Where did that idea of the happy club come from? Like, do you feel like you've... Because I've always felt very joyous around you, even when I log on today, you know, looking at images from the past. Like, it sort of does bring a joy of life. And I think it's something people really need to be reminded of, particularly at the moment. Because as you know, you've witnessed it yourself in your lifetime, the kind of circular nature of the far right, and then how things progress, and then how they go back again. And I don't know, I just feel like you're this constantly positive energy in the world.
It's
hopeful for me.
But yeah, that's my work. It's remember, we had to write out an edict about my work and everything. And really, it's just about joy. It's about celebration of life. Because all of us, we're not here very long. I mean, we think we're here forever. But we're not. And so I think it should be celebrated. And we live in this wonderful world. I mean, I'm very passionate about Gaia at the moment. That's about where the world is. Yeah, the world is an organism. And we're part of that organism. We think we actually own the world. We do not. We're just another part of the tree, is as much part of the world as we are. We're just rather dominant, and we're raping it at the moment. And I don't see much, whether perhaps we can go for a few hundred thousand or years, I don't know. But it's there is, of course, a lovely movement at the moment that recognizes this. So, kind of, my sculptures at the moment are all about that, and my thoughts as well. Because it should be celebrated. It's gorgeous, this world. Mm. I mean, I'm lucky. I live in mid Wales. We have ancient oaks here, lots and lots of them, and little hills. And, well, my friend from India, because I'm a great Indiophile, he came from India. And when he arrived, he said, oh, my goodness, it's like being in heaven. Because it had fluffy cows and ancient trees. And, I mean, there's more sheep than people here, which is ridiculous to have a museum where... We can have lots of sheep coming through, but we're building. The museum now has been open 32 years and houses really very early works and alternatives, all the Alternativist World regalia portraits. But it's only a small, it's converted squash courts. The locals say, oh, the old squash courts. So they still went, I mean, after 32 years, they can't recognize it as a museum. But it's ideal for it. But it's quite a small building.
So it's been described as the nicest and friendliest museum in the UK, officially.
Oh, lovely. Well, thank you very much.
Why did you want a museum? I mean, I can understand why you'd want a museum, but why did you, in 1991, open this space?
Up to then, I'd had exhibitions, various exhibitions. Well, exhibitions can last from 6 weeks to 6 months. And I noticed that when people would say, oh, I'm so sorry I didn't manage to get your exhibition. And I was thinking, my work's about joy, so I want to bring this to the world. And it was, I think, my great friend Barbara Hulniki, who was, I did Bieber's roof garden for, huge sculptures up on her roof garden. And I remember she, this glass house in the sky, we were near Liverpool Street Station then. It was a, it was an interesting building. It was on the top of a roof. And I think it was before they went to Hollywood, they used to shoot silent movies on rooftops in the East End of London. And I think this is one of them. So she'd had this Japanese coach trip come, and they all came round the studio. The studio was packed with sculpture, and they were all taking photos. And I thought, well, this is rather marvellous. And so that kind of prompted me. And then I thought, well, if I open a museum, then people can go anytime they can't. And also it'll be open after I've gone. So there'll be a nice legacy. This is my legacy. People have children. We have far too many in the world. But so my legacy is this: these things, the beauty and joy. And that's what I'm going to leave the world. And hopefully a lot of people will be able to see them and get to inspire people. I want to inspire people as well.
Do you add to the museum? Because I know you're infinitely creative and you're always making, I remember that of you, but are there things that are constantly being added?
I wish. I'm always saying to enjoy. Let's pop this in this corner. My friend Dougie Fields, who always, when he came once, I think, to the museum, but he always loved it because it was very, very open. You know, you could see each piece for what it was, whereas I'm kind of cram it all in and see many pieces as you can. I think, well, we, as Dougie, we had the, he made a little thing. It was all about maximalists versus minimalists. And we are the maximalists. So you fit as much as you can in. And in fact, I've rented a mill nearby, 5,000 square feet, which I've kind of filled with work already. So, but I can't stop. I can understand people like Lucian Freud and all these artists. When you get to an age, all you want to do is paint. So all I want to do is sculpt, really. I'm happiest in my little studio over there, creating things. It's just, it's glorious. It's just, I'm very lucky. I am very lucky that I'm able to do this. As we know, so many people in the world aren't able to and get frustrated and so, but I think we can all create if we want.
Do you make work every day then, Andrew? Are you in the studio every day?
Yes. Not today, because I had the COVID injection, so I thought I'd better rest. But virtually every day I'd go and do something, yes. It's the very nature of working every day. It shows you a direction, certainly in your work, where you're going to go next. It's always fascinating when you see retrospectives, and you can virtually, in the early paintings or sculpture, whenever you look at the first things, you'll see that all the way throughout the artist's life.
Yeah, we have noticed that when we talk to a lot of artists, that a lot of the things they were doing as a kid has actually defined their practice, the images they sort of drawn to, the materiality, absolutely. Yeah. Well, I'd love to talk about, you know, the materiality of your work and the objects, because when I think of you, I think of mirrors. As Rob said, it's this reflection. It's this kind of this broken glass and resin, and there's like sparkle, and there's this like lurid plastic that comes in there. I would love to know about the process behind each object and how you start, because also there's a Duchampian sort of like ready-made feel to a lot of the work that you have them, but they have sort of existed before they came into your orbit, and then you kind of molecularly changed them all and then sent them on their way.
Yes. Gosh, that's a lot of... Well, first of all, in 1967, I was studying architecture at Oxford. I qualified as an architect after 6 years. I had a year out, in which I spent in America working. And I was lucky enough to go in 1967. There was an exhibition called Dada and Surrealism in the Museum of Modern Art. When I walked into this exhibition, and there was this taxi, old-fashioned taxi, and it was raining inside the taxi, but the couple is sitting inside with it in like a jungle. It was a Dali. It's a Dali taxi. It's made by Dali. And then I, of course, went round and I saw Magritte, the whole lot. And I thought, this is fun. This is, and that really was my early inspiration. So I kind of followed that. So I never do drawings unless I have to communicate with somebody who's building. For instance, my Millennium Pegasus on Dudley, on the roundabout in Dudley, is 20-foot winged Pegasus in bronze. So, of course, I had to show something. But even that actually was wonderful because I always say, but talk about the art mafia, because this wasn't the art mafia. What it was Steve Field had asked me, he was wonderful at the local arts organization, and he asked me to do a little Pegasus outside the Glass Museum in the Crystal Mile in Stourbridge, which I did. And then he phoned me up and he said, "This is competition for roundabouts, for sculpture on roundabouts in Dudley. Would you like to enter?" I said, "Oh, I'd love to." So he said, "Don't worry." He said, "I'll just enter it for you." So he did. And it was a competition whereby they had an exhibition and the public were able to go and choose the ones they wanted. And my particular roundabout was about the future, facing the future. What is the future? And they chose Pegasus, which was very nice of them. And so that was... But I always thrilled, really. And since then, they have a Pegasus Club where they look after the sculpture.
Oh, wow.
And it's,
a happy club, happy Pegasus Club.
Yes, they're happy.
Yeah. So actually, looking at the brooch that you're wearing now, how does that start? Because I think a lot of people, if they look at your work or they Google you, there's lots of brooches, lots of numbers, and there's the crowns, obviously, that you make every time for the Alternative Miss World. How do these objects begin, and how do you pull all these materials together?
See, look, it goes up, week up. Inspiration comes up, it comes down into here, and then comes out from these hands. Mm-hmm. That's it.
Magic hands.
And I just sit at the desk in the morning, or I go in. Obviously, when you've started to build a sculpture, then it takes care of itself. It will create itself. You are merely a tool. So there I am working away, and I create this. I love doing portraiture. But I don't know if you know, but I've got two pieces in the National Portrait Gallery, one of Sandra Rowe and one of a big mobile in Seymour. Sadly, I've never had any commissions, which I'd love to be doing commissions of heads. And I suppose they're very unusual. People normally they don't really fit into any little box. That's my, in a way, it's wonderful. But when people don't want a portrait, they have something conceptual or something oil or something, but something where it can be labelled. Mine, there is, I am what I am. What you see is, that's it. Which is all, because I don't have a gallery. I mean, I was a great relationship with Angela Flowers, who's, of course, just gone.
Just passed away.
And she was my great friend. We first met when I was the errand boy in the ICA. I'd come back from America, and my friend Yasha Reichardt was doing a very groundbreaking exhibition called Cybernetic Serendipity. And it was about computers, way before computers, and robots. And I was the errand boy, so I had to race around London picking up photos and things. And in the lunch break, I used to sit with Angela next to the bandstand, and we'd chat. She was working in the finance department. We'd just sit and chat and have a nice time. And that was before she opened her gallery in 1970. So it was a very early relationship. So I did have a relationship with them. And but it's a moment I'm working perhaps with Rebecca Hossack to take my works to Miami. But all that world is so remote to me because I'm...
Well, you just mentioned art mafia earlier on when you were talking about the roundabout in Dudley. Who is the art mafia then? Who are you referring to there?
Well, I suppose it's just the chosen ones, isn't it? I mean, it's the luck of the draw. You think of Dougie, brilliant artist. We never got a look in. And so it's just the time, the place and everything. But I think what you'd have to... And like Dougie, same with me, you just have to work every day and just keep working. As the Dalai Lama says, never give up. So specifically, I suppose one has just fed a very few artists. I'm not wishing them the best of luck, and they've been very successful and everything. There's, of course, so many other people that we never see and that I find sad. I mean, it's getting better, of course, now with yourselves, of course, and you're now spreading the message around the world. But it, for a long time, it was very provincial, really.
I feel like that's also, in the introduction when I described you as alternative, it wasn't just a reference to alternative Miss World. It's also about, I feel like your work and you as an individual have created a space for people to feel free and to kind of liberate your creativity.
Yes.
And to, the main message I always took from you is to be yourself, and that, you know, that's a beautiful thing. And if you can just commit to yourself and trust yourself, you know, you can share that with the world and hopefully make it a better version of the world than when you arrived. And I also have always thought about you when I'm in places like Barcelona because of Gaudi. And it's funny, even like talking about Pegasus and like Greek mythology. And that for me, even in like, if I go to places like Greece, I often think of Andrew Logan. Like there's different places where I've been to all over the world, even where I see Andrew Logan. And there's something quite universal about your language. And I was wondering if that came because you did study architecture to begin with, like your kind of interest in buildings or in how they are constructed, because there's something so like made in your sculptures. They feel very sort of alive worlds.
Yes. Well, I started architecture. I thought, what am I going to do with my life? And I thought architecture because I thought everyone needs a roof over their head. So I'm going to be an architect that I can build houses for everybody to live in. But as, of course, the years went by, and actually I had an acid trip in 2 years before it was a 6-year course, so it would have been 2 years before the end. It was very controlled. We had somebody with us. And it's a funny little story, I can tell you this. And first of all, the sun was going down, so I started drawing around the shadows down this wall, the shadows going, and I was drawing the shadows. And then the wall in this digs was dark, dark blue, and there was a bowl of fruit on the table. And I picked up this orange, and I threw the orange at the wall. But normally, the orange just says, but not this orange. It just kept going. And so I thought, now, if I can do that, I can do absolutely anything. So that gave me confidence. Because you could remember, I was always, it's such a fragile age, that confidence. Often, I don't say, let's all take drugs, but certainly, there's something, you have to open yourself to the world, and something will indicate where to go next. I always think that's very important all throughout life, really, is to be very open. And that openness, it will bring you in, bring you into other realms. And of course, we're talking about international, because most of my major works are in India. The latest being in Mumbai at the airport. My great friend Rajiv Sethi, an extraordinary man. He did, I think the airport has 1.5 kilometers of art in it. These canyons, and they're just filled with art. So what I did was a 45-foot installation with a wooden backing of Rajasthan fascia, doors and windows in it. And on it, I put 23 portraits, some mirrored, some three-dimensional. Oh, it was called the Guardian Angels of India. And it's the people who formed India, like Gandhiji, Tagore, Krishnamurti, Bollywood stars, freedom fighters. And it's lovely working there because I've worked with many artists. So that's always been a thrill because I think, again, of being positive, I wasn't getting the work here over the years. And Rajiv offered it to me. And so I did huge sculptures. I did the cosmos within this 23 truncated cone, which has stars and galaxies, and it's open as I open to the top. You go into this inside of this cosmos. It's and the reflection. I think it's the only time I've ever seen a visual wittiness. Normally you get it with sound, but vision not so much. But this with mirror, it all reflected and kind of melted into each other. And I love mirror because it's such a simple material. We're talking sand. Mm. You know, you just go to the beach, and there it is. Melt it down, there's your glass. And it's magical. And I love that concept of taking things from the gutter. I've always liked picking things up that have been rejected and making them into glorious works. One of my, which I started to do when I got COVID, And, oh no, it wasn't COVID, it was my cancer. So sorry. I had prostate cancer. So I was on treatment in Royal Marsden. And I started getting charity shop paintings. You know, the little oil paintings in charity shops.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, never injected. And so I took a kind of kit with mirror circles and all sorts of bits and bobs. And I recreated them in a whole new thing. I think I've done about 20 so far. I've never shown
them. Oh, wow.
They're... is again, it's that thing of taking things that have been rejected and just glorifying them, because everything is wonderful.
I like the way you describe mirrors as a moving, living being. And I read this story about, because the mirrors appear in so much of your work and in so much of the jewellery, and some people will then complain to you if a mirror cracks. But for you, you say that's the mirror's wisdom revealing itself. That's the mirror's decision. That's, I'm not in control of that. That is, you know, the time changes and mirrors are living, breathing things.
They certainly are. Basically, mirrors, I call it a physical manifestation of the spiritual. It's, the work is, I'm playing with light the whole time. I mean, there are artists, Anish did those great big, like a big pebble thing, didn't he, in Chicago, which is wonderful.
Yeah.
What I tend to do, my cosmic egg, which I created in 1983, which is 5 meters tall, 2.5 meters across, it's in the museum, and it was commissioned by the GLC for the Battersea Parade. And then it was supposed to go actually underneath the Haywood, there's a shelf. It was going to go there. And then Thatcher, you know, she cut the throat of GLC and that was it.
And the GLC was the?
Greater London Council. But I often describe it as a black hole because it just sucks in the images around it. So it doesn't all exist. But of course, it's refracted because it's not a solid mirror refraction. It's many, many refractions. And that's why I love doing these wall pieces as well, because I've got to a stage, actually, I discovered an oil-filled glass cutter made by the Japanese. I must have discovered it 25 years ago in Covent Garden. Changed my life, because it's like working like a paintbrush. You can cut glass in such shapes. So I started doing wall portraits of some huge ones. But what I love about it is you can see yourself in the image, but also they're very much like the people I represent, and uncannily so, because we're talking about a brittle, dangerous material, absolutely opposite to flesh, totally opposite. And I just keep piling them up, really, basically. I've got...
Well, they're so uniquely yours, and there's no one else. I think you said there's no one else in the world who's doing mirror portraits.
In the world. I did a 16-foot picture of Dougie from his painting, with his arms, you might know the image of where he's got his arms out, saying, welcoming you. And I did a 16-foot portrait of him.
Wow.
We went, in the early days of our podcast, we went and interviewed Sir Ian McKellen, and on his wall, I think he won it in a charity auction maybe, but he has this piece I'll show you now, but it's like a man's face.
Yes.
And the hair is all collaged bits of glass.
Painted glass.
It's like so beautiful. So painted glass, exactly, the black hair. And at the time we were joking because it looked like one of our friends, Pedro Pascal, who's since become a very well-known actor. But I think the post when we did it, said, oh, look, he predicted Pedro.
He's the Maharaja of somewhere, but it's certainly Indian.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Indian. And I gave it an auction. Yes, and Ian has it in his... I always thought...
Yeah, we saw it.
Remember Andy, my sister always says this, you know, Andy, when he... Because I knew Andy when I would go to New York, I was popping to say hello. But he started...
This is Andy Warhol you're talking about. Yes, right. You say it's all like, casual. You know, everyone knows Andy.
Well, I suppose people are so familiar, aren't they? It's awful. I should be a bit more proper. He did a whole factory. It's called The Factory because he produced these. He'd go out for the dinner party. He'd get a commission, come back. And then there was a guy called Ronnie Catrone, who I knew very well, who did most of the painting, actually. Andy would come along and just go... But Ryan did most of it. But he was so successful. And so I thought, perhaps a mirror, you won't find trying to have to make an income. I thought, this could be it. This could be the answer. But funnily, it doesn't seem to be at all. I don't know. Again, I think it's because people like an oil, he worked in oil or acrylic. It's like a painting. Whereas these are not. And they're totally unique. So it worked for me in some ways wonderfully, and others not so. But there you are.
How have you stayed focused, then, Andrew? When you talk about times when it's been obviously hard to make a living through your art, how have you maintained your kind of mindset to keep that focus and keep the work?
Well, I remember it was really difficult when it was really difficult. Molly Parkin introduced me to this man. He was wonderful, and he was had a prosperity. He was a prosperity counselor, a prosperity club. It's called Sean. Oh. And so I used to go and see him once a week, and he would tell me how to. It's manifestation, basically. It's where you imagine, you write all these lists of your hopes and wishes and everything. And actually, it's very good for a lot of people. It's a good tip. You just write down what you want, and this will all come true. And you just have to write it down once a week. And that's what I did. So that very difficult time, actually, it was. But then we were very fortunate because Michael and myself, we'd always been in the East End of London, which you've got to remember was non-gratis until very recently. I mean, no one went to the East London. I mean, Butler's Wharf, my God. I mean, people were terrified. 1975 Alternative Miss World, when I sort of moved in there, and we were there for 4 years or something. The sights, yes, it was, but it was magical. I loved it because it was sort of being in the country, but not, because there was no one in East London at all. So you could just have, it was like a playground, really. You could go for these endless walks. No one around.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
That's, of course, when Derek was in Butler's Wharf, and I remember when he was doing Jubilee, you'd often see a sort of a finger going up and down the staircase, you know, the cut finger and things.
What was your friendship like with Derek?
Well, I was very fortunate in that we had the early years with Derek, that wonderful, magical period of finding your way together. I think once you've found the formula, then it becomes a bit more predictive. But this early period where we were just all playing, 70s, everyone had gone to New York to the factory because of Andy Warhol. And London was kind of abandoned, and it was marvellous. It was cheap. People could squat. It was easy to get round. And we all just had fun, and we'd all meet up. And there weren't many artists. I mean, now there's thousands. I mean, then there were just a handful. And so Derek and myself played. And so it's when I've got all these funny movies like Andrew Logan kissing 25 personalities.
What's that? What's that for? Can you see that anywhere? Is that in your museum or is that online?
No, it's online. Yes. He did all these Super 8s and he shot, of course, 1973 Alternative Miss World. That was when he was determined to win. He was going to win. It's funny, when people do win the Alternative Miss World, so often they then become hugely successful. It's almost like an invitation. This is it now. You're on now.
That's so funny. Well, you've had that with Lee Bowery, and John Mabry is one. Lee Bowery came as Miss Fuck It. Yes. John Mabry was Miss Windscale Nuclear Power Station. You've had Grayson Perry in the early days as Miss St. Clair Perry of Essex.
Divine was involved too.
Divine.
Yes, 78, yes. Poor thing,
And you were shrined to Divine in your museum as well. Yeah.
He had no idea what it was about. No idea. But he became such great friends. He loved England. I suppose about 15 of us, really very close friends. So we'd go on these wonderful expeditions. I remember going to Stonehenge and him lying on the sacrificial altar, which was fabulous. We just, And I introduced them. There was a holographic exhibition in Bath, and Princess Margaret was present. Well, he almost sort of fainted. I mean, the thought of royalty and Princess Margaret, it was wonderful. He loved having tea at Harrods and all sorts of... He was such fun from this wild woman from America.
Yeah, from all the John... Yeah, people who don't know, Divine was... a superstar in the John Waters B-movies that were all being made at the time.
Right.
And the big one being Pink Flamingos was a huge, huge cult success and an amazing personality. And I think definitely was someone who would have inspired Lee Bowery. Yeah. I think Divine was pre-Lee. Is that right?
Divine was doing a performance. Can you imagine the middle of the river? He did everything. He was so game. And it was one of these cruise ships, and it was the middle, and it was the gay celebration, and that was on the South Bank. So he because he was a disco queen, they got on the roof of the boat. If you imagine anything in his high heels, and sang. It was quite extraordinary. But afterwards, he came down, and I always remember this because Lee was there on the boat. Divi was at the top of the steps. You know those big steps in boats. They have a quite And Lee literally just looked at Divine and then he just fell down the stairs, rolled down. And Lee was marvellous at that because he was big and, you know, fancy. He was able to do all these wonderful things, including this one. And I think Divine just giggled. But he was one else. They did meet. Yeah, they did meet. And
wow.
Tumbling down the stairs.
You were there when they met. That's incredible.
Oh my God. I was always really curious as well about, like, in the 70s, because it was such a melting pot of different creativity. It wasn't, like, siloed off at that point. And that's what I've always liked, that inclusion kind of spirit of different ideas. But even, like, Vivian Westwood, Malcolm McLaren, Sex Pistols, it was like that moment was actually in your studio. Do you know what I mean? Like, what's that like? Like, Was it mad when you start to see them become these mainstream?
Yes, well, Malcolm and Vivian, of course, it was, again, a small community. So when you, Vivian and Malcolm, and they'd done Let It Rock or whatever it was, and Sex. And so we knew them. And Malcolm, I gave parties virtually every week in Butler's Wharf. Because there were no clubs. No, we couldn't go anywhere. So off I would just do a party once a week and we'd been to Bieber's Roof Garden to the closing down, and Michael and myself bought the old from the children's department the castle. Well, we thought it was in fiberglass. It wasn't. It was plaster. My God, it was made a ton. Anyhow, we rebuilt the Alternative Tower of London in the studio. It was 2,500 square feet. This huge studio, and. That's where I first met Divine. He came to my alternative Jubilee Day, and we were squatting. We didn't even have toilets, but it didn't matter. So they would come, and then one day Malcolm phoned me out. And he said, "I've got these kids. They're going to be bigger than the Beatles." I said, "Oh, how wonderful!" He said, "Can they play at your party?" I said, "Of course." And I was open to everything. So that's what. We did it on February the 14th, Valentine's Day. Along they came, and it was so funny because we never heard anything like it before. And Jordan was there, of course. Well, the roof, it was a huge roof. It had a corrugated ceiling, the studio. So any sound reverberated like hell. Well, of course, they started. Well, of course, we all ran into the porter cabin, the gold porter cabin, because the noise you couldn't. So that one.
Who was it?
Sex Pistols.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it's an iconic moment, basically, in history now. It was called the Valentine's Ball, and it was 1976.
And this Vivian is Jubilee, who was a star of Derek Jarman films, Jordan, who was a star
Jordan,
of
yeah.
not Jordan as in but Casey
she was,
Price.
She was but the Jordan. Girl in the so called shop girl in La Sade Now Gone.
Jubilee.
But she was sat in. The sex, you know, in Malcolm and Vivian's shop.
In Chelsea, on King's Road. Well,
had this extraordinary look. Right. It was wonderful. And always, and I think, wonderful when she wore twin set and pearls with that look. It was brilliant. It was so witty. She was so witty.
Yeah, a real
and she
punk.
Also was a trained ballerina. I remember one party we had at Butler's Wharf. Jordan came in her little tutu and everything with that fabulous makeup. And she did this wonderful dance, ballet dance to us, for us all. Because I built a stage, you see, in the, because this, it was all built because of Derek's Sebastiano. The court scene was there. And in this scene, and really everyone who was anyone was in that scene for Sebastiano. But sadly, Derek had fallen out with the editor. So when it came to editing, he destroyed all the footage, which was really sad. I remember I had a lemon toga on. I had to say some words. I had a big medallion with the Eiffel Tower. You know those sort of three-dimensional plates? I had one of those three-dimensional plates. So I had to say some words, which I got cut. Sadly, when you were seen later, it would have been amazing. And Lindsay Kemp and everyone there was...
Talking about them now, them days, do you miss those days? Do you feel like that's something that could never be repeated?
Well, nothing's new, is it? I mean, nothing new. We all think it's all new and everything. It's all been done before. I mean, even 2,000 years ago, I'm sure they've done it before. But it's interpretation, how you do it. And I think they were joyous days. But it can never be that again because the world has changed. And of course, it will continue to change. It will change in your lifetimes as well. So what you have to do is enjoy some of the beginning. You have to enjoy it on the way. Just enjoy it as much as we can and celebrate it because the change happens. It's going to happen, whatever happens, the change. But we were just very fortunate that, you know, the city was cheap. We were able to create together. And we all did create together. So there was the Rocky Horror Show in the end. That's when I knew Richard Hartley, the composer, and I met Brian. Actually, Brian had gone to New York. He came back in the 80s. Brian Eno, of course, had collaborated with a lot later on. He's about to, very excitingly, he's going to be singing at the Festival Hall, I think, at the... In October. He's a brilliant musician. I admire Brian so much. He's... Because almost he's out on the limb in a funny sort of way. And so that time is very special. But it's wonderful because eventually your life, when it comes to the end, is just full of memories.
Also, I've always felt like you've been quite lucky with kinship in terms of, like, you know, other creatives that you almost became family with. You know, like Xandra and you, and you've been on this kind of whole journey together. And I know she's become immortalised in your sculptures. You've made giant sculptures of her.
But also in the National Portrait Gallery.
At the National Portrait Gallery, the bust. Yeah. There's some amazing works that you've made of her and that you can really feel your love for her.
Yes. I think that's very true. I just admire her so much in that she's... You always say to Sandra, what are you doing tomorrow? Begins with a W and ends with a K. Well, I mean, you could reinterpret it in other ways, but this is work. Every day she's there, irrespective, she's working. And now, of course, she's a wonderful legend, which is terribly funny because she goes to all these things and just flown back from China. She was in China last week. Because of my legacy to the world, I have she got inspired by us. And so she's now realised she got cancer. And so she's realised, well, she's got to sort stuff out because she's got 10,000 dresses. Well, I mean, what do you do with 10,000 dresses? But she's doing it. They're going to be shown, you know, left all over the world. So she's formed a foundation and so kind of tidying things up. We all still have fun on the way. Sadly, that's what I do miss, being in Mid Wales. I mean, it's wonderful for work because I never stop. But I do miss, of course, just popping into Sandra because we were neighbours. So we would often, you know, borrow some sugar or something. It's that kind of... So that for me is, but there you are, it's change. And so when we do go, we see her all the time.
I feel like brother and sister when we see you, like a brother sister.
We saw you at the opening of the new National Portrait Gallery and we came over and you just look so
like brother and sister. It's lovely.
I wanted to give you all the big hugs.
I think she's also said that she only wears your jewellery more or less.
Yeah.
She does more or less. Yeah, she has a huge collection, which, I mean, when she was doing collections, fashion shows, I did collaborate with her. She's about the only person I think I did. And then I did start to use younger. I'm very open. If people ask me, I will do. And I'm not very good at saying no. So people have asked me. And then this is with Stella. She is a sweet story because her dad there was a charity called War Child in the 1980s, of which Brian and Anthony Eno had started. It was really supporting children in the war in Bosnia. A wonderful idea. So they did an auction, and I gave a piece. I made a piece especially for it. And it consisted of a little cosmic egg, mirrored cosmic egg, and stuck through the middle was a fork. And it's called Feeding the World, Feed the World. Well, when I think her dad got home, he stuck it in the lavatory. So every time she went to the loo, she saw my piece. So about a month ago, she contacted me and said, oh, I've always been a great admirer of your work. I love your work. Let's do something together. And I said, wonderful. And that's how I ended up in Paris. And I admire her so much because she's really sticking her neck out. I mean, there was these stalls with a 1,000-meter-long catwalk, open air, down the street. On one side, chairs. And on the other side, stalls, all eco. So, for instance, people making material out of grapes and also out of apples.
Wow.
Real, like, leatherette almost. Quite amazing what you can do. And she's promoting it. And I thought that was absolutely wonderful. So it was a great joy, really, to work with her. And hopefully we can do more in the future. I think she's very...
So is your work part of the collection now? Will it be available as part of, like, the same dialogue as her clothes?
I don't think so. I'm not sure.
So it's for the show. It's the spectacle of the show.
It kind of looks almost like couture kind of, like, pieces, because it's like, you know, that they're artworks, yes, essentially. Right. And there's a beautiful Pegasus, or horse, at least, on the back of
that's
one
it,
of
the... Yeah, the black. Beautiful. Yes, the black... Exactly. And so she wanted to celebrate my work. She felt I'd been copied. I'm not sure about that, but anyway, I suppose I have been over the years. Well, and people are welcome to it. You know, if I can inspire people, then that's good. But with copying, you can only go so far. You know, you've got more steps to go. So she wanted to celebrate my work and felt I'd been underestimated also in that world. So she said, come on, we'll put Andrew Logan on the catwalk, which she did, which was wonderful.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, and she's always supported artists as well. Yeah. And I feel like there's that element of transformation in what you do. And she's really interested in this idea of, like, new materials, like you were talking about, like a lot of her handbags and her mushrooms, or, you know, all these different things. And this idea of transforming something in your hand into something you can actually use. I don't know. I feel like, because your art is, in a way, quite interactive and usable. You know, you can wear it, you can look in it, you can sort of become part of it. It kind of becomes part of the environment.
Well, I've always made practical things. I mean, my first show, 10 sitting rooms in, no, I guess that was the first show, 10 sitting rooms, the ICA, that was 1970. But then I did a one-man show, my first one-man show, 1972, at the New Arts Centre in Sloane Street. It was a small gallery with a small front door. And I showed, it was called Plants and Flowers for All Occasions. And I made these series of palm trees and then a great big fountain with water coming out. And we used to have tea parties. And then I had mirrored birds and things hanging all over the place. And then my friend, because I had the walls empty, I had a great friend at the time called Johnny Udrathews, who just started taking photos. I said, oh, Johnny, do you want to do the walls? So he took photos of all my friends. And which he ended up having a show at the National Portrait Gallery. So it was very jolly. And I'd had a life-size horse as a settee on the pavement outside. And I decorated the window with net. And I remember one man came in saying, I thought this was an art gallery, not a hairdresser's. It was so frou-frou. But I'd made everything to fit through this door so that even this huge fountain, which is now part of the Lulu Fountain in the museum. It just fitted just by a centimetre under the door. So I've always made things because I think big Pegasus, of course, that was bronze, but mostly I do make things that are very practical, that can be even, and they're made of mirror, but they're very strong. They might look, people say, oh, you're very theatrical. Well, perhaps I am, but theatre, I think, made things only just for a few performances. But I make my things really to last forever, or not forever, because we may not be here forever, but certainly a long time.
Well, I've also read in recent years that you've had to apply varnish on the back of certain items because you sign and date everything. And over the years, as people have worn them and loved them, the signature or the years sort of worn away and it's hard for you to track. But now you put this layer of varnish to preserve the date and your signature.
You're very well informed. Yes, down to the varnish. My goodness. I'm very impressed. Thank you.
Big fan. Big fan.
But it's true. Yes, they had worn out. I thought it was enamel paint. So I thought, well, it should last forever. But it didn't. But now, of course, so I can now engrave on the glass. So sculptures are now engraved. Right. So as long as the sculpture's around, the signature will be there. So on major pieces, but obviously for jewellery, I can't engrave every single. But anyhow, who wants to engrave Andrew Logan on? You know, I think there's a great obsession with names. You know, you people walking down the street and they're just covered in names. That's what they want.
I think it's a bit
boring, really. Why not cover themselves in, I don't know, toothpicks or something? It'd be much more interesting.
I'd love that. Yeah. I think Rob's thinking about that now.
Ages ago, like I think the same year you founded your museum, when you did your retrospective at Museum of Modern Art in Oxford, what was that show like for you? Was that like a really significant moment? Because I can imagine that's like a homecoming for you, because it's kind of, you know, where you grew up. But also it's like within the art context, you know, that's probably the slightly, I mean, maybe not in 1991, but I think Modern Art Oxford is definitely part of the art world.
1991, David Elliott. What a man. It's like everything. It can go, the art world can go one way or the other way. I think if David had been appointed head of Tate, it would be a very different world. He was the first person to bring in Chinese art to this country and Russian. I always remember coming to, it's a little story again. I'd been to the Caesar Tagore show at Museum of Modern Art in Oxford. You know, Tagore, the philosopher and poet, North India, and he has started a school, wonderful. Okay. And he was really a writer, a philosopher, very deep, wonderful, wonderful poetic man. And he had this, there were small paintings, but they were magical. Well, anyhow, and then went to the girl at the desk and I said, oh, this is a wonderful place. I'd love to have a show here. And she said, oh, I'll talk to my directors. That was David Elliott. David phoned me up a few days later and said, I'm coming to London to see your studio. So he came to the studio and it was crammed, absolutely crammed full with work. And he said, I like that. I said, oh, fine. Well, it turned out, he said, I'll have the lot. I'll take everything. And that's when the retrospective happened. So wow. I made this yellow brick road. It was out of Fablon, I think. And it was a yellow road that you followed. As you walked through the gallery, you went down the road. And it started with the very first piece I ever made as a student of architecture in Oxford. And it went through this journey of alternativist worlds. It was a wonderful show. It was a wonderful show. It encompassed everything. I mean, Brian had even done a piece there. I remember it was called Bud, and it was an inspiration from, I had a show in Singapore and British Week, and I'd been to Burma and to Thailand, and I did this thing based on the Buddha, and he did this wonderful piece of music that as you got closer, it got softer. As you walked away, it got louder. It was so clever. So as you got that, it's almost imperceptible, the sound when you were near. And then as you walked away, it got louder. It was so many things. Wow. Egypt visited, endless.
I think we need another Andrew Logan moment in a big museum institution. That's something that is needing to happen.
An updated retrospective.
But you just mentioned Russia then. And before we get to our final questions, I would just love to talk about something I read where you were a celebrity in the former Soviet Union in the 1990s and what that was like.
I first was asked by, it's always mad, isn't it? This mad, mad world. There was British Week in Moscow. It was in the 80s. And two guys, American, had been asked to organise performances in or art in Russia. So they approached me. It was my first jewellery performance I ever did on these beautiful models. My goodness, they were fabulous. In the Sobin Centre in Moscow, which at that time was prohibitive. It's like the prostitute look, I call it. Everyone has it nowadays. But then it was, you know, the short skirts and the blonde and all that, the eyelashes and things. And they were all hanging out at this hotel. and only foreigners were allowed in with, and you had to show your passport or something. And I always remember where I stayed, there was a madam on each floor. So she was obviously getting takings. And in the electrical cupboard, when you looked in, there was a surveillance set up. It was all, you know, every room was wired. But they'd abandoned it by then because Perestroika was happening. So no one cared about anything. And it was fabulous because it meant Soviets had stopped, capitalism hadn't come in, and everyone was having a party. And the Russians know how to party. I have so many lovely, I think the funniest times I've had have been in Russia. Sadly, as we know presently, it's very sad. But at that time, it was hysterical. And I went to something called the Untamed Fashion Assembly, organized by a man called Bruno Bermanis in Riga, in Latvia, whereby he asked all creatives, mostly designers, to come from all over the ex-Soviet Union to celebrate in this beautiful town. So I met people from all over the Soviet Union. And as a result of that, they all asked me back to their festivals. So I went to Perm, Ekaterinburg, Kiev, St. Petersburg. I mean, you name it, I went. And it was absolutely wonderful. And I think they love my work because it is joy. They've had 70 years of greyness with Soviets. So, and the amazing thing was they knew exactly who I was when I arrived in the 80s. They'd underground system with all the magazines, because I was in quite a lot of magazines then. In all the magazines, they knew exactly who I was, what I'd done. It was incredible. They were so well informed. And so there was one particular artist called Andrei Bartanev, who I remember when we first met, he couldn't speak anything. He just loved my work. We just exchanged works. I took his paintings and he took my jewelry. And since then, he's now very successful and household name in Russia, but he now lives in Spain, of course. It's rather difficult to live in Moscow. They've even got works of mine. They've got Museum on Art in Moscow has one of my mirrored portraits, one of the Russians went for it, of a huge portrait of Rudolf Nureyev.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Which I did. And I did meet him actually through my friend Lynn Seymour, and went to see him. And funny enough, again, strange enough, in India, I was with Sandra and we were in Delhi. And he was at the end of his career there, but he was still dancing. That was a great privilege. So people I've met are really, it's wonderful. I mean, but again, open yourself up and it'll all happen.
Absolutely. Well, talking about trading works then, that gets us onto seamlessly into one of the talk art classic questions at the end. The first one is, if you could do an art heist, Andrew, and you can have any work of art in the world for yourself, what would it be and why?
Oh, any work of art?
Anything.
Oh, anything.
Yeah, it can be giant or tiny. We could,
it can be a building, could be a
helicopters,
shrine.
Yes, anything. I can have that's a question now. Goodness, I've been asked that before. I think it would be, I think India would be very nice.
The whole of India?
Yes, whole of India, please.
Yeah, fine. We can sort that out. It should be fairly easy.
I was actually going to ask you earlier, like, I remember Howard Hodgkin always talking about the impact India had on colour for him. Mm. Is it a similar thing for you? Like, yes, has it really inspired your use of colour?
When you go to India, forget all your senses, vision, smell, everything. You have to re-educate yourself. It's madness. So you have to rethink everything when you go to India. Mm. And it's a place full of surprises. The colour is, well, as Diana Freeland said, you know, from Vogue, Diana Freeland said, pink is the navy blue of India, which I always thought was a very good quote.
That's great.
Love that.
And it is magical. Even now, it's changing rapidly because, of course, they're now becoming like Asia. China and India are becoming the next wealthy nations of the world. I mean, they're going to be world dominant. But there were still pockets. And as I said, my great friend Rajiv Sethi had showed me so many sides of it. And I still do, though, a workshop. It's called Wonderful Workshops, which I've done for 15 years. I do a week in Jaipur, and I just guide people through my technique. And Jaipur being the center of jewelry and textiles, and for an artist, is an incredible place. It's just gems and oof.
This sounds great, like a jewellery making workshop.
Yeah, I do, but jewellery, not some do jewellery, some do mobiles, cover frames, do all sorts of things. I always were interested because always the person that always says, I've never done art, I don't know what I'm doing, what can I do? They always come out with the most interesting one because they're not biased, you know, they've no inhibitions at all, which we should all have, no inhibitions, just go for it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Oh, love that. The other question we ask every guest is, what is your favourite colour?
Pink.
Which orange, leads on quite well.
Orange, yellow, purple, green, blue. What I missed out. The only colour I don't have, I mean, I use it sometimes. I mean, Matisse used to use it all the time, which is you never think that he would use that colour. That's the dominant colour in his work, is black.
Ah.
You look at the piece next and you'll see why.
But it's all the outlines as well, isn't it, I guess?
It kind of formed the basis of it. I suppose in a way, but even when I use black resin, I usually sparkle it up and colour it. But I don't, when I go to funerals now, I have purple.
Mm. Right. What's the best advice you've ever received when it comes to your work?
Dalai Lama, never give up. Never give up.
That's nice.
That's advice for everyone. Never give up. But the tip I've always added to it is be compassionate and kind to your fellow human beings. That's most important.
Yeah, I agree. We need that more than ever at the moment.
Well, Andrew, you are joyful. Absolutely. This has just been a total pleasure. For everybody, we're going to be posting images. We're going to link to Andrew's incredible website. You must all go to Wales and visit the Andrew Logan Museum and Sculpture.
And then the museum will open next May. It's 10 to 1 weekdays and 10 to 4 weekends.
Okay. And is there another alternative Miss World planned soon?
Yes, there is. I mean, it should be. Martin Green, who's done so many of them with me now, is wonderful.
I love Martin.
Yeah,
I love Martin,
gorgeous, yeah. Martin. He said, I've got to do it in 2025, because I will then be 80. So it'll be like round the world in 80 days.
Phileas Fogg, yeah. Round the world in 80 years.
Yeah, it'll be 80 years.
Myself and Rob will try and compete if we have an opportunity.
My God.
The theme is Gaia, of course. It has to be Gaia, doesn't it? The world we live in. So it'll be fascinating.
And for everyone listening, you can also buy Andrew's book, which came out last year, Reflections. It's a beautiful book, and it's a wonderful way to bring the colour and joy and vibrance of Andrew's world into your home if you don't have a piece of jewellery or sculpture or something. But yeah, we love you so much.
Oh, yes, and there's a shop on the website privilege. Well, for people who want to buy the jewellery. It's incredible. Like, there's so many amazing pieces on there. It's
just go to andrewlogan.com. And you can also find Andrew on Twitter and all the socials and all that stuff. And we'll be linking to you, Andrew. We have so much love for you. Thank you. And can't wait to see you soon.
Thank you,
and
Robert,
we will be back.
Thank you so
soon.
Much. It's been absolutely marvellous. Wonderful.
Oh, we'll be back very soon.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening.
Bye.
See
you soon.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamond and Russell Tovey.
Follow us on Instagram @TalkArt, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in today's episode, with music by Jack Northover.
Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts.
Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.